Jonathan Lucroy and closer Jeremy Jeffress were sent to Texas. Left-handed reliever Will Smith may be going to San Francisco. On the scoreboard, the Padres beat the Brewers 7-3. Kyle Hendricks allowed just 7 hits and got his second career shutout last night as the Cubs beat the Marlins 5-0. Hendricks' complete game gave the bullpen a needed breather after their 12-inning win the night before. The forecast, mostly sunny today, a high of 85, a 40% chance of showers and storms this evening and then again tomorrow. An overnight low tonight around 68, tomorrow's high 85. Expanded forecast, hot and humid Thursday with a high around 90. Partly sunny Friday, a little cooler, a high of 85. Could see some more showers and storms Thursday night and into Friday. Right now, 68 degrees. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The morning show with Gregory Berg is coming up. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu. /grad. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD HD. I'm Gregory Berg. Another Olympics is about to open, and tonight on PBS, two different documentaries are airing that relate to past Olympic Games. One of them is a marvelous film for the series American Experience, and it's called The Boys of 36. It looks back at the dramatic Berlin Olympics of 1936, which were played out under the watchful eye of Adolf Hitler in the inner circle of the Third Reich. One of the stories to emerge from the 36 Olympics, largely forgotten today, is of the completely unexpected gold medal performance of a rowing team from the University of Washington. It was one of the biggest upsets of the Games. The woman largely responsible for this film is Margaret Grassi, a documentarian who has done fine work in the past for HBO Sports and NBC Sports. This is her first film for American Experience. She co-produced this film with Mary Carrillo. Again, the title of the film is The Boys of 36. Can you say a quick word about what got you into the business, that is, into the business of making sports documentaries and sports films? And do you come at this as someone who was or maybe still is an athlete yourself?
I played sports in school, but I did not have the great gift. I'm about 5'2", and I played well on a high school level, I guess. But I've always also been a fan of sports, all sports, really. But I didn't grow up knowing a lot about rowing. I'm from the Boston area, and I have friends who row and row at the head of the Charles. And I always thought it was a very beautiful sport to watch. But I had no idea how kind of grueling it is and the kind of dedication it takes to really do it well and succeed. As far as getting into documentaries, as I said, I'd always been a fan of sports, and I started my career working in sports, but more of it was sort of live television, more short form kind of sports programs, which I think was kind of what was popular. I'm older. Back in the 80s, I think it was more popular to do live television. And now that we're getting into a kind of a content age as opposed to which network you work for. I think that long form is really taking off. And for me personally, just getting a little bit more into a story, really digging out all the pieces of it, was attractive to me. So I kind of made the transition that way.
Hmm. Did this particular story cross your path in any particular moment or in any particular way? I mean, or for a long, long time, have you somehow known about this this team of rowers, the so-called Boys of 36?
I did not. Mark Sammels, who is the executive producer of American Experience, sort of had his eye on this story. And he had known some of the work that we've done, our team had done in the past, and he contacted me about doing it. But once I picked up the book and started reading it, Daniel James Brown's Boys in the Boat book, which this is based on, you could see right away that this was a very visual story, a very American story, and very appealing in its underdog theme. So it was kind of an automatic for me.
Ahead of us talking specifically about these young men and their story, I think it would be helpful to our listeners to make sure they understand exactly the sport that we are talking about, the event in which these young men were entered at the Olympics, and also a word about just how very popular this particular sport was back in the 1930s for some reason. So first of all, explain exactly the sport, even the exact name of this event that we are talking about.
It was referred to, it was the last race of the day in Berlin, and it was the premier race. It's referred to as the heavyweight eights, the eight ord 2,000 meter race. And these boys were used to rowing longer distances in other races during the season. And in fact, there aren't that many races during a rowing season, apparently. There are maybe two or three. But the IRA, the national championship in Poughkeepsie at that time, was a 4-mile race. This is 2,000 meters, which is significantly shorter. So it would be like asking someone who is a cross-country runner to suddenly run a sprint at the Olympics for the gold medal. So no pressure there.
And we should probably describe visually what we are talking about. And I think once we do that, people will know exactly the kind of racing that we are talking about. We're, of course, talking about a long, narrow boat, which I think is called a shell.
And that's right.
And in there would be then the oarsmen seated sort of parallel to each other, and then one person at the front of the boat serving a very important function. Explain that.
Yes. They're actually kind of stacked one behind another in rowing, as most people can see it when they watch some of these races, if they ever have. But these are big guys too. They're really big. Six feet, it would probably be kind of considered average. Even at the time, Stunt McMillan, who was in what they call the engine room in the middle of the boat, he was at least 6'5".
Wow.
And they're in a shell that at the time was made of cedar, not very wide, 62 feet long, with eight of these big guys in it, having to row in complete, kind of synchronization, harmony. And then one coxswain in the stern of the boat, who is necessarily shorter and lighter, who's not rowing, who's steering the boat and commanding the boat. I can't. There's not another sport that I've, been a fan of or experienced physically that's like it. It's one thing to think about, say, someone like me. I've, of course, been in rowboats, in canoes, in kayaks. But these big guys who could probably just as easily play football or basketball in this very sort of delicate wooden shell, trying to be in perfect sync, going down a river or a lake with the wind in their faces and the waves and competition right next to them is amazing. The amount of dedication to this is amazing. These boys also, of course, at that time had to deal with thousands of spectators in Berlin chanting in their faces while they tried to do this. It's just amazing that they pulled this off.
Absolutely. And the film says that this was a tremendously popular sport, one of America's most popular sporting events back in the 1930s. One thing that we catch an intriguing glimpse of in your film is the view not only of certain fans just in the stands, as they might be for a horse race or a track and field event or something, but even people loaded into some sort of almost like a train car that would be yet another way to experience this race. Explain what that was.
Observation trains. That was, when I saw that, that was probably the most kind of stunning visual to me once we were looking at through the archival footage. I don't think they exist anywhere today, but I sure wish they did, because anybody who's been to a race knows that you sit on the shore and you get one glimpse sort of during the race, because you have to sort of park yourself in one spot. And it's a little frustrating if you want to cheer for somebody that you're interested in, a team that you're interested in. This train ran alongside. The train was in Poughkeepsie. I know that there were trains in Seattle. And it ran on a track alongside the race course. So people could buy a ticket and sit on these trains and go along the course with the shells, with the boats, with the competition, and the entire way. And really root for their team the entire way. It was just neat. It was just really probably Daniel James Brown wrote such a wonderful book, just a beautiful story. But I think our job, and hopefully he's kind of happy with it, was that to find visuals to go along with it. And when we found this, it's just really something to see. It's really kind of delightful in a way to see these people enjoying themselves on the train, watching these races. I wish they could bring them back today. I think it would bring more people into the sport, frankly.
Sure.
And then the other remarkable thing for us was to see these thousands of people. And again, being a sports fan and knowing the history, I'm a big baseball fan. So of course I see a lot of footage from the 30s of baseball. Obviously, the fields, the stands full of people cheering, horse racing, the same thing, boxing in the arena. I would not have known this about rowing. That was kind of a startling thing to see as well. Thousands of people on piers, on ferries, on yachts, cheering for these races, these rowing races.
We're speaking with Margaret Rossi, who is the director and co-producer of an American Experience documentary that airs tonight on PBS called The Boys of 36. In it, we are learning about an American team of rowers that managed to capture a gold medal at the 1936 Berlin Olympics under the unlikeliest of circumstances. I want to be sure that we talk about sort of the background of some of these young men who were part of this team, and one man in particular whose striking personal story is told in great detail. First of all, though, I think we should talk about the strange gauntlet that was part of how the team at the University of Washington was sort of handled, and the way in which the team was constructed with these various groups of young men grouped together in various boats and so on. It's kind of a chaotic picture, and I'm not describing it very well here. I will leave that to you. But I think it's important because it's an intrinsic part of understanding the special challenge that these young men were facing.
Your struggle with trying to describe what went on there was our struggle in the edit room as well, because it's a tough very competitive process, apparently. And at the time, was overseen by a very stern coach for these boys named Al Albertson. And there are eight spots in the boat, nine really, counting the coxswain, and hundreds of boys trying out for these spots in these boats. And again, at the time, with an eye toward the Olympics, you know, one boat that was really going to make it. So it was a very competitive process. And I think probably I can't pretend to know all the ins and outs of how this works in a rowing season and in a boathouse with a team. But I do know that, you know, I have felt the competitive juices in the past. And I think, again, with a sport like rowing, where you're getting up pre-dawn and you're rowing in all sorts of weather, and you dedicate so many hours to this and have to stay in such great shape, you really want a spot in that boat. And as I say, there are only really nine spots. So it was very competitive, and you had a coach who was kind of driven to get to the Olympics, sort of obsessed, who himself was a star, stroke oar, it was called, in the boat the previous decade.
Got to the Olympics himself.
He never got to the Olympics. And so that drove his obsession even more. Mm.
You
and
also
so these
just.
These boys felt this. These boys really felt, I think, took on his. The stress and anxiety of trying to get to the Olympics.
Right. You also described this particular coach. Was his name Albrechtsen?
Al Albrechtsen.
Al Albrechtsen. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He is described in the in the film as being, what would the word be, maybe taciturn. I mean, someone who was not given to, you know, to lengthy explanations, sometimes no explanations at all in terms of who exactly was going to end up in what boat. And particularly as the Olympics approached, he was not averse to setting in motion a process of sort of filtering out and shifting around, which left so many of these young men really bewildered and unsettled, not knowing where they were sort of in the grand scheme of things. And it helped create a very tense situation.
That's right. The sports writers of the day used to refer to him as the dour dame. He didn't say a whole lot. He wasn't someone who kind of motivated boys with a generous spirit. He, again, as we say, he was obsessed with getting to the Olympics, and so he was going to do what he needed to do to get the best boat, and this often meant shuffling these guys around in various boats to get the right combination, regardless of sort of their feelings about it. Mm. And so it created trust is such a big part of this sport. It's such a big part of success in the boat, and yet in leading up to the Olympics, the season prior, there was an utter lack of trust in that shell house, and it cost them. It cost them for that season.
Right, and you tell that facet of the story especially well. We need to talk for a few minutes at least here about the young men themselves, and one young man in particular, whose personal backstory you tell in great detail, and I just can't get over how moving and compelling this portion of the film is. Ahead of us getting that specific, I suppose as you began work on this film, you had the names of the nine young men who were the eight or young. Wait, how many are in the boat? How many are in the
show?
Well,
there are nine.
Okay, yeah, eight rowers and then the person at the front of the boat yelling to keep them in sync. So, yes, yeah, so nine young men. And I suppose you began this with a list of nine names, but at that point not knowing anything at all about any of them. Just say a word about sort of that process of discovery, of learning who these men were And then realizing what kind of compelling stories were to be found in their backgrounds.
Without even getting specific about one guy or another, they all were going through the Depression at the time, and they all were from the Pacific Northwest, which at the time was still kind of considered the frontier of this country. They were sort of forgotten about. They were sons of fishermen and lumberjacks, and they worked. Tim Egan in the film refers to them as grunts. You know, they had to just work very, very hard. So right off the bat, you're intrigued because the typical image of a rower is an Ivy Leaguer, you know, an East Coast Ivy Leaguer. So that's who, as a whole, as a group, that's who these boys were. Then we got to know a little bit about each of them. Not one of them came from privilege. And many of them had to do had to get to school in the first place with no money. A lot of them went without food. Again, as Tim Egan says in the film, a lot of them came to the university so they could get fed. This was the Depression, after all. Roger Morris had to help his father move families out of their homes because they couldn't afford to pay rent on the homes anymore, mm-hmm. or mortgages. That's a lot to put on a kid, on a young kid, watching,
right.
having to remove families from their homes.
Yeah.
But then there was Joe Rantz, who was pretty much the main character in the book. He was abandoned by his family. He lost his mother when he was 4 years old to cancer. And then times got even tougher. And his father and his stepmother tried to keep going, tried to, you know, kind of create a new family. And Joe was sort of left out on the fringe of that family. His stepmother had some issues with him, apparently. And he was left behind. But as we find out, that wasn't a rarity during the Depression. A lot of families had to kind of leave some of their children behind to fend for themselves because they just couldn't feed them. I can't fathom that. But
right.
That's what went on.
And in, of course, the case of Joe Rantz, this ends up being, I was going to say a young man, but the first time his family essentially abandons him, turns him away, he's 10 years old, forced to live at the schoolhouse, the local schoolhouse. And
That's right. And
later on in his life, where you describe the scene where his family has packed up the car and are moving to a new community, but leaving Joe behind, he does not get to come with them, and he is essentially on his own to fend for himself as a young teen. What among the many remarkable aspects of that story is not just that Joe Rantz doesn't turn incredibly bitter and sour and sort of walk down a road of self-destruction, but that he even manages to stay in school throughout all of this tumult in his life. It really leaves us with great admiration for him and for his character, which is so severely tested by all this.
Well, you're hitting on the thing that resonated with me the most, the thing that stuck with me the most about this story is, without romanticizing it too much, I would often take a pause as I was reading the book or reading articles, researching for this, and kind of let myself long for that sense of purpose that these boys had. I mean, you feel a great deal of admiration for these boys and for Joe Rantz because, as I say, it would have been enough for me to try to get a job and get through school and get myself fed under those circumstances on a daily basis. But these boys were learning to row on top of it, and learning about higher virtues like trust and character. You know, I think the hard work ethic was probably already there. But it wasn't for Joe Rantz just a matter of survival and taking care of himself, as he had to do for most of the early part of his life. He then had to learn those higher virtues, especially trust, trusting in the other guys.
Right.
That had to have been a very, very difficult. It's one thing to talk about it, but on a daily basis, it had to have been a very, very difficult thing to do when all you knew was to take care of yourself for really your survival, not just your livelihood, but your physical survival.
Right.
So that was quite a remarkable story.
One of the saving graces in young Joe's life is when his older brother is able to finally extend a hand of welcome for him to come live with him in, I believe, Seattle. And so he spends maybe his last couple years of high school with the first real stability and love that he's experienced in his life. And another figure who is important, in a sense, in his redemption, particularly as a young athlete, is not so much the coach of the Washington team, but an intriguing gentleman by the name of George Pocott, the person who is responsible for designing and building the shells, those boats that in which they row. But he also seems to have played an important role in Joe Rantz finding himself and achieving the greatness which was always within him. Say a word about Joe Pocott.
George Pocott was a wonderfully spiritual character, and I think he was, if not the difference maker for these boys, at least one of them, very significant character in the story. He was a quiet man, a spiritual man, a man who was very proud of his craft, who really respected his craft and respected I'm trying to get the words here. He really had a great amount of respect for the sport and for the craft of rowing. And he used that to show these young men that how to respect something, how to trust in something, and how that made you better as a human being. And he took Joe Rantz aside and really tried to impart this to him. And I think more than just whatever words transpired between them, George Pocock was right there. His boat shop was above the shell house. He was there every day, and he was a quiet man going about his craft every day. And I think that speaks louder than words for these boys, to see that the dedication and the respect that he had in a very quiet way. He just set an example for them, and Joe picked up on that.
It makes all the difference in the world. Your film takes us through several years of spirited competition there at the university, and early successes for some of these rowers as freshmen, a difficult second year, and then redemption is eventually theirs. A last quick question. One of the most interesting bits of drama plays out in Berlin when one of the most crucial members of this crew is stricken with serious illness, to the point where the coach wants to pull him the morning of the race and set in an alternate. Explain what the team's response to that is.
This is, you know, as we go along through the film, and we see these boys learn about trust. We see them learn what happens when there's a lack of trust, and then we see them learn how to trust and what the strength that they gained through that. And I believe at that point they had become so strong as a team and trusting each other so much that this young man, Don Hume, who had become very ill as they were going into the gold medal race. There was a Coach Ulbrichsen was possibly going to replace him, wasn't sure he could row. These boys, his teammates, stood up for him and went to this coach, this formidable coach, this very stern coach, and let him know that they wanted him with them. If they were going to row this race, no matter what happened, they wanted to do it for each other. And I think when you get to that place, that's the culmination, really. Even more to me than the gold medal. Because that's character, and that is something that you can carry through all of your life.
Margaret Grossi is co-producer, along with Mary Carrillo, of this American Experience documentary called The Boys of 36, airing tonight on PBS stations across the country, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee. Part two of today's morning show is coming up in just a moment here on WGTD. It's 8:41. A second documentary airing tonight on PBS stations across the country, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee, is a film called Munich 72 and Beyond. It looks back at the 1972 Munich Olympics, which were the first Olympics hosted by Germany since the infamous Berlin Olympics of 1936 with Adolf Hitler. The organizers of the 1972 Munich Olympics envisioned them as and billed them as the so-called friendly games or cheerful games. But sadly, those Olympics would be indelibly linked with the tragic incident in which 11 Israeli athletes and coaches were taken captive and murdered by Palestinian terrorists. This film examines not only those tragic events in 1972, but also the ongoing, tireless efforts of family members and others to have those Israeli athletes and coaches properly memorialized and this event properly acknowledged by the organizers of the Olympics. My guest in this portion of the program is Dr. Stephen Ungerleider, who is a renowned sports psychologist and author whose books include Faust's Gold, Inside the East German Doping Machine. He is also a founding trustee of the organization Global Sports Development. It is under their auspices that this documentary film was made. He is one of the producers. The film, again, is called Munich 72 and Beyond. One of the important stories told here, as you've just touched on, has been the sort of ongoing ordeal of family members who lost loved ones in this Munich tragedy, and of their relentless efforts to try to learn as much as they could to understand more about how this happened, why this happened, what exactly happened, to whatever extent we can know the details of whatever horrors unfolded in those dormitory rooms. I wonder if you could say a word about how the families over the years have contended with this, and in particular, the really formidable and compelling figure of Anke Spitzer, the wife of André Spitzer, one of those who was killed. She, of course, in so many respects, almost serves as the face for all those who suffered such a terrible loss in Munich.
Well, it's a good point. She is the spokesperson for the families, although all the families were involved, but an extremely powerful, incredibly articulate individual, broadcast journalism journalist. So she has a great presence when she speaks, and really has been, along with other family members, just persevered over the years and not allowed this thing to just wilt away. The families have been to every Olympics, either a few members or in some cases all the families with their children went in 96. And there have been memorial services and different events that have occurred, but never a full acknowledgement, which is what the families have asked for. I will say, without giving too much away, and you'll see this when the film is aired, there was some new material that just surfaced. The German government had done several investigations, along with the Mossad, the Israeli Secret Service, and there were pathology reports, there were pictures, there were thousands of pages of investigations as to what went wrong and how the Germans were not prepared for this, and there weren't sharpshooters, and things just were completely out of sync. There was no such thing as a SWAT team back then, and if there was, they didn't show up. So there was some new material that surfaced as we were doing the film, and we were allowed to use the material, and you'll see in the film pictures that were shown for the first time. And so that added, a powerful visual to the trauma and what the struggle has been throughout all these years, and also the frustration of the families having to fight the German government to get the material. In fact, there was a wrongful death lawsuit that took 22 years to resolve, and the Israelis won the suit and were paid a small sum of money for victims' compensation, but more importantly, got access to the documents that were being concealed in a private file. So every step of the way, there was some drama, and it still continues.
Regarding the matter of certain details that have recently become known, which people can learn about through watching your film, details which really underscore that this event included brutality that no one had really imagined before. I suspect that for you and the other producers of this film, one challenge was to decide, in a sense, how much of that to share, how gruesome a picture to paint of what occurred in Munich. And again, without going into any of the specific details, I wonder if you could just say a word about that sort of, I don't know, ethical or artistic wrestling match, which was probably underway in terms of trying to decide just how best to handle this difficult aspect of telling the story.
Well, Greg, that's a really elegant metaphor that you use. We did. We were there during the interviews. So all of us were in the room when we heard some new material about torture and some of the things that happen, which the viewers will see. And so we were pretty shocked. And as I said, I've been around a long time and been to a lot of Olympics and thought I knew the story completely and found out that there was a lot that I had to learn. So after one particular taping session, we all had to leave the room and just get some fresh air. It was quite traumatic and upsetting. And then after we came back to the States, we had some soul searching and discussions around ethics and creative license and what's the appropriate thing to do. We had, of course, some legal issues. We had to sign off and get informed consent from all of the victims and the families, which we did. We followed that protocol very strictly. And then we had to do some real internal searching as to what would tell the story in an appropriate way, but in a dignified way. So you're right. There was a lot of wrestling amongst the team and some very, very productive dialogue. We all got along very well and agreed to disagree. And in the end, I think the film speaks very well for itself. But it was very emotional. It was extremely emotional for all of us to sit through the interviews and hear the story, but then learn the backstory, which was new.
One of the most interesting aspects of this, and I'm not sure that your film actually explores this, but I suspect you might have some thoughts on it, is what the reaction of German officials was back then, in more of the immediate wake of this tragedy and disaster, that surely they felt a terrible sense of guilt, and perhaps didn't know what to do with that guilt. Can you just say a word about that? About what sort of sense of responsibility was felt at the time and in intervening years? By those who, at least in indirect ways, perhaps played some part in this situation being handled so poorly.
Well, I think you're right. There was an enormous amount of guilt and remorse, and we failed, and nobody likes to fail, especially at a worldwide stage of the Olympic Games when millions of people were watching on television. It looked pretty bad, and the facts bear that out in all the investigations that and reports. The German police and the both the state and federal agencies were not prepared, didn't have the proper security folks in place, didn't have anything close to what we have today. An Olympic Games typically today cost between 17 and 20 billion, that's B, billion dollars, and over 2 billion is spent on security. So you have a sense of what it takes to put on the games and how many agencies are involved, both at the local and state and federal, and then private security forces who now travel with the teams, and some athletes have their own private security. It's a very sad commentary on where we are in the world, but the facts are security is a big issue. So yes, there was a lot of collective guilt, and then of course the Mossad, the Israeli Secret Service, while the tragedy was unfolding over a 36-hour period, Israeli agents had to get permission from the German government to enter the country, because at that point there was a rule in place that only German officers and state security would manage the security. And the Israelis offered to bring in special teams, and we know that the Mossad are quite famous for doing pretty amazing rescue attempts. This has been well documented. And they were rebuffed. They were told, you can come, but you have to sit at the airport, and we will monitor your activity. And there's a whole piece that we talk about where the head of Mossad, who we actually interviewed, who's 92 years old, told us that he was talking with Prime Minister Golda Meir and Moshe Dayan, General Dayan, on a landline, because there's no such thing as a cell phone back then, and they talked for hours and hours and hours, but he was only allowed to be an observer. He could meet with a few people, but he had to stay in one room, and he was contained in that room, and he saw this whole thing unfold and reported back to his government that they had their hands tied. They weren't allowed to do anything. So it was very painful, and I think to hear the victims talk about what could have been done to save lives is another painful chapter.
The heartbreak just sort of piles upon heartbreak in this story, doesn't it?
Indeed.
What can you tell us about how the survivors are doing now, given these recent developments, the long-awaited acknowledgement, the construction of a memorial in Munich, and, of course, other efforts that one hopes makes a difference for the better. What is your sense of their emotional well-being? None of this, of course, reverses the events of 1972, nor brings any of these loved ones back to life. What kind of difference do you think it has made in their lives emotionally, or is it difficult to say or generalize about that?
Well, I think it helps with some of the closure. Clearly, now that the International Olympic Committee and the German government have worked with them to have the memorial, gives them a sense of optimism, and this will these horrific moments and nightmares will never be erased ever. But at least there's a place to cope and deal and grieve, and some closure can be gained by that. And it also is a place where people can come from all nations. In fact, President Bach has been talking to our team about when it opens in 2017. It's not just an Israeli and German Olympic thing. He wants members from all of the Olympic family, which today is now 205 countries. It was much smaller back in 72. He wants representatives from every country to be there, because this is a moment of Olympic solidarity and letting athletes know we want to embrace you, we want to make you safe, we want the Olympic movement and Olympic soil to be a place where people can lay down weapons and come together and compete on a level playing field and have fair play. So I think the president and executive committee is making an important statement, and I think it's being well received. I think the Israelis and the victims feel optimistic about the film, optimistic about the memorial. There's also opening ceremonies is Friday, August 5th. We are our members of our team will be there the first week for a number of meetings. But on the 3rd of August, 2 days before opening ceremonies, the Olympic Committee is holding a special service, and they've asked a number of people to come together with the Israeli families to talk about these developments. And I'm told that NBC will be doing some coverage of that. So I think all in all, taking all these pieces and putting them together, there is a sense of hope and optimism. And I think the Israelis are and the families are feeling much better.
Well, we should certainly hope so. And in the meantime, of course, this film airing tonight helps to also deepen our understanding of what happened in 1972 and of the importance of remembering it and acknowledging it properly. And, of course, for those too young or otherwise who have maybe even forgotten those events, although it's hard to imagine anybody forgetting something so tragic, this film perhaps will serve that purpose as well. The film, again, is called Munich 72 and Beyond, airing tonight on PBS across the country, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee. And one of the film's producers, Dr. Stephen Ungerleiter. Dr. Ungerleiter, I so appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today on The Morning Show. Thank you so much for your time and for your good work.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, in place of what was originally scheduled to air, I'm going to be rebroadcasting a conversation that I recorded some years ago with a singer by the name of Marnie Nixon. She is probably best known for the beautiful singing which she did for the film tracks of three major musicals, My Fair Lady, The King and I, and West Side Story. But she had a long and varied career. And by the way, she was born here in Wisconsin. And she died last week. And so to commemorate her great work and celebrate her life, we'll replay my conversation with Marnie Nixon tomorrow on The Morning Show. We talked on the occasion of the publication of her memoir called I Could Have Sung All Night. On Thursday's Morning Show, we'll be talking with Nancy Matthews and with one of the reenactors who is part of the Root River Rendezvous, which takes place this weekend under the auspices of the Kenosha Public Museum. Also, I'll be talking with Joe Nissen about this weekend's Starving Artist Fair in Racine. And on Friday, a look at the intriguing career of a outstanding American swimmer who is back at the Rio Olympics. He won gold back in 2000. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings